Dan is just going to say a brief thing about how it happened that Man and Mercy ended up in this man's hands in South Africa. Because some people have heard that story, others are curious and haven't heard that. And then we're just going to start with comments and questions instead of having them talk first. What they have to say, I think, would be better just coming out of conversation and questions and comments and have it be right from the start conversation. That's what we're going to do. I'm going to introduce the forum by reading a short little story, couple paragraph story, about my son Isaiah. And it connects to something I learned from Dan, which is the peacemaking practice of wearing a paperclip. So, anyone else wearing a paperclip for peacemaking? All right, well, here we go. One night at the dinner table, I noticed my 8-year-old son Isaiah playing with his ear of corn. Before I could say anything, I was stunned into silence by what he was doing. Holding his ear of corn vertically on the plate with one hand, he flew his other hand toward the corn, saying, "And here comes the plane flying into the tower." We had not been talking about September 11, 2001. We had not even been talking about war or global politics at all that day. We were enjoying a weekend meal on vacation with family in rural New Hampshire. At the moment, it became clear to me how profoundly his life is marked by the horror of that day. In response to September 11th, Isaiah made his first effort to connect his faith in the world of politics. We were very worried about exposing him, then only 3.5 years old, to too much of the outrage, sadness, and fear that we felt those next days and weeks. Yet we had dear friends in New York, and our anxiety about them, coupled with our general reaction, filtered through to him loud and clear. He began to call it the bad, bad thing. Why, he would say, did those men do that bad, bad thing? To which we would say, "We don't know, honey. We just don't understand." We prayed for everyone we could think of, including President Bush and Osama bin Laden. We talked together about the need to pray for leaders and the difficult challenge Jesus gave us to pray for our enemies. In the weeks that followed, it became clear that we would attack Afghanistan, seeking to destroy al-Qaeda and punish Afghanistan's Taliban leaders for giving al-Qaeda safe harbor. One morning in October 2001, Isaiah suggested that perhaps he could write to President Bush and send him 2 paperclips. He reasoned that if the president were to wear 1 paperclip and Osama bin Laden were to wear the other, then they would know not to fight. I had chosen as a young man to commit myself to the discipline of Christian peacemaking. As part of that commitment, I took the practice of wearing a paperclip on my shirt as a witness for peace. The practice grew out of World War II. Bishop Burgrave emboldened a peaceful resistance with his preaching. As part of the resistance, school children began to wear paperclips as a sign of rejection against the power of the Nazis and their racist policies. While the Nazi soldiers would constantly remove the paperclips in irritation, the school children always seemed to find more. Isaiah had tried to remove my paperclips many times, leading to the conversation about this unusual peacemaking practice. Isaiah wrote his letter and sent it off to the White House, complete with 2 paperclips attached to the top of the letter. As a parent, I was moved by his vision and insight. But was I also being naive? Can I really expect anyone to take this example to heart as a guide to faith's role in the political sphere? Can I seriously take issue with Madeleine Albright, who in that same fall argued in a speech at Yale Divinity School that, quote, "It would be preposterous to apply Jesus' teachings about not resisting evil and turning the other cheek to contemporary challenges in foreign policy," end quote. So we're gathered here tonight to talk about that question of peacemaking in the midst of terror and horror, and about to what extent it is preposterous. So, let's just follow the silence that I'll now let fall in the room and ask questions or, oh, I'm leading into that thinking we're ready. But before we enter into questions and comments, let me just have Dan say a couple of words about the travels of Manna and Mercy far flung across the ocean, and then we'll have a moment of silence to open up questions.
I'll speak loudly. I taught a class once in California, and a woman came up afterwards and said they should bottle your voice and sell it for insomnia. I will try. And one, the paper clips, I use this in a sermon once, a paper clip story. By the way, Norwegians invented the paper clip. I told the story about the children wearing paper clips to school every day during the war, and a visitor, a man that I never saw again, came walking out of the church and shook his hand, and I saw that he'd been crying, you know, and I asked him, about it, and he says, "I'm one of the school children that wore a paperclip." So that was very, very touching. Now, Manna and Mercy, we visited and toured and traveled in South Africa. I can't remember how many years ago. It might be a decade ago on a with a church group. And no, this was even earlier. It was our first trip to South Africa. And then one of the people we met there was Kistner. Do you remember his first name? Wolfram Kistner. And he was probably the leading Lutheran theologian in South Africa. We had a delightful afternoon at his home. And if I remember, I think I gave him a copy of Manna and Mercy. And then he showed the copy to Alan's father, Peter Story. And then, oh, by the way, no, the first person that, no, we have to erase. The first person, it was Tom Soldner, who some of you know, that's spent years in South Africa, that brought one over there. And then he's the one that gave it to Kistner. Then Kistner gave the copy to Peter Story, who evidently gave it to his son, Alan Story. Does that sound right? No? Okay.
And there you have it. From the author himself. Well, let's just have a moment of silence to let questions clarify in your mind and comments. And then if people would raise your hand, that would help us not to just have people jumping in. And also consider sharing once and then waiting a good long while so that lots of various voices are able to get into the conversation rather than one person who's very excited sharing many times. Is there someone who's ready to begin with a question or a comment on this topic? Yeah, please.
What would you say to Madeleine Albright?
saying no to Marlborough, saying it's preposterous to apply turning over the chief parking policy.
Well, first thing that pops into my mind, I would ask her for 15 minutes to explain the studies on Jesus telling his followers to turn the other cheek. And it was an example of nonviolent resistance. And just very briefly, it was a way a higher up would put a lower person in their place to humiliate them by striking them on one cheek. And then the way it was supposed to end, that person would just cower and leave totally humiliated. But they had back in those days, they had a special rules about how to hit people. And it was, it'd be too long to explain now, but if you would hit someone on the right cheek, you would do it this way. And if the person, as an act of resistance, turned the other cheek, the person who did the hitting, which most likely was a much higher up, would have to distort his body into such an awkward position that it would give a chance for the lower person to catch him in the eye. And then in that moment of connection, when the lower person had assumed power, there was a possibility of dignity and reconciliation. The one who's done the study on this is Walter Wink. Anything to add? It's disturbing when you hear so often how, with, for example, battered women, that counselors, often Christian counselors, would say to follow turning the other cheek. And that then will maybe eventually convert the batterer, which is absolutely wrong. And I hurt when I hear someone say that this was advice to an abused woman.
Other people want to respond to that question. Ways that you view that kind of a dismissal of Jesus as preposterous for foreign policy.
My quick kind of quickie response to Madeleine Albright is perhaps the teachings of Jesus are preposterous, but I don't think there are necessarily any more preposterous than blowing random things up. That might be where I would start if I was feeling cheeky. But I mean, being that we're talking about the foolishness of God, I don't know if it would help to say to someone who didn't share my view of how God works in the world, that sometimes a preposterous or foolish seeming thing ends up being the solution that actually works. I don't know. But mostly I think I would make the point that blowing things up is kind of preposterous as well.
I would give voice to a neighbor of mine who lives in a slum in Caracas, Venezuela, who on a morning jog with me told me that basically he's waiting for the United States to be the first nation to lay down their weapons of mass destruction, and that would better the world and would set the example for others.
This isn't really a statement, it's just kind of a question going off of that. From the panel, what do you think the world would look like if, miraculously, our government and our world, well, at least I guess let's just focus on the United States, decided to follow maybe not necessarily Jesus, but just a peace? Do you think that would work? And if it did, what would that look like?
It's your turn.
Like Holden Village. I'm not sure what it would look like. I don't start with the end in mind. The question earlier as well, for me it's, I start with Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I ask myself, how did Jesus live? How did he teach us to live? And he made statements like, as simple as can be, love your enemy and pray for the one who persecutes you. He taught strategic nonviolent direct action, like the turning of the other cheek. Nothing passive, but nothing demeaning. He realized that Satan can't cast out Satan. He realized that war can't get rid of war, that violence can't get rid of... So it's a failed instrument. It's failed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really all need our heads read why we keep using an instrument that's never, ever, ever succeeded in achieving that which it has promised to achieve in the history of the world. War has never, ever brought peace. The victors write history, unfortunately, and so they tend to think that it has brought peace, but in fact it hasn't. So I start with Jesus. If Jesus says love, and he didn't just say it, he did it. And I trust, I've come to that place to trust that Jesus reveals God more accurately than anyone else I know. And so I've decided to follow that way. So the way I worship and love God is by following Jesus. I do not know any other way. I'm not saying there aren't other ways, but I do not know any other way. And to trust the results of that into God's hands. And I have a sense that the results of it may not look too successful. Just as the cross did not look like a success. But we trust God with the results, and it may take some days in a tomb for those results to be born eventually. So I'm not focused on results. It's focused simply about trying to honor the life of Jesus, and in doing that, I believe that's the greatest faithfulness towards God that I could ever do. So that's where I start. And I take him serious. I make no divisions between my relationship with Chris right here and how I need to practice it and across continents. I think it is a false divide. And yes, it should influence every aspect of our foreign policy. And yes, how does this nation ask any other nation to get rid of their nuclear weapons or not to ever make, when we on this soil have more than anyone has ever had, and we're the only ones that have ever used it? It is full of hypocrisy. People from outside of this land where I come from, I mean, it's just a joke. It's an absolute joke. I mean, like, who do the administration think they are? They can drive a car, but no one else can? It doesn't make sense. So I would say, starting from Jesus, interpersonal, and it should influence everything. And let's trust God with the results. We may be surprised if this nation had to radically disarm, how this nation will be welcomed again by the rest of the world. We may be very surprised. I would want to believe there's huge grace.
Back here, Chuck.
I felt really awkward when that question came up and started, because I have this sense that important changes like that have never really been started with leaders. They're usually the last ones to get a clue. So I think that the appropriate thing is what we've been hearing the teaching for a couple of weeks, that we who are just ordinary people are the ones that have to do something or say something or be something. And we certainly have gotten a huge offering from this kind of teaching of what the possibilities are. And they really do, I think, start with common people. Mm-hmm. And so let's go, common people.
Amen.
And,
let's go back here.
My initial reaction, Jigar, would probably be something like, what really feels preposterous is that Jesus' teaching should be more bound to a specific time and place and situation in history and not be a living truth. It just that's what's really preposterous.
Thanks.
If we go home and talk these words, a very common response and a question is going to be one that I certainly couldn't answer. Looking at history, the easiest war to talk about is Second World War, because we had wickedness going on with what Germany was doing. I mean, that's not debatable type information. What should have happened? What should England have done? What should the U.S. have done? We've got realistic wickedness. What do you do when wickedness is spreading?
I have a go at that one.
It's Dan's turn. So
oh, Dan. Go, Dan.
I think I know how to answer it, but I'm afraid it wouldn't convince many people. And the Second World War is often used as the example of, it's called the Good War, you know, and the Greatest Generation, as if this war were different than other wars. And I think I personally believe that is false, that there are all kinds of things that led to this war, and that we weren't the innocent. But how do you ever convince someone of that? And I what we need to do is, the propaganda about this war has been very intense and very successful, and also so many families have the memories of now would be grandparents who fought and died in this war. I still remember as a child our congregation weeping as we put a silver or gold star up on the banner on the wall. And there is so much to move through to answer this question in a way that would convince people. And, you know, mine would be, as Alan said, war has never worked, and this one really didn't either. So, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Dan, about asking the question of what, you know, you frame the question, which in some way the question is framed in such a way that you give the person answering the question very little movement. We need to extend the question. Like Dan said, what led to it? What were the ingredients that led to it? There are many ingredients, and there are many contributing factors that all the Allied forces were involved in that contributing process. No different to this war, we need to ask who trained Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. We need to ask who propped up, Saddam Hussein. I mean, who met him? Who greeted him? Who shook his hand? Who gave him a hug? That's right, Donald Rumsfeld. Is that all just forgotten? So we've set up dictators, we've propped them up, we've fed them, and then when the wind changes a little bit, then we want to destroy them. And so there are many ingredients that go in, and this is what happens. Then we get to the brink of a war, and forgetting the ingredients into it, and then we think that a war can now solve this issue, or end it, which just lays the ground, which becomes very fertile for more things. So we use conflict as a necessity to need war to end the conflict, which then forms new basis to have another war at another point, and it just goes on and on, and it really is quite pointless on that regard. That's the one thing. The second is that the military is the largest institution in the world in the last 100 years. It has had more money, more intelligence pumped into it than any other industry in the world. Nothing comes close to the industry of war making. We call it a defense ministry or defense, I think it's got nothing to do, it's about war. It's about war. When people say I'm willing to die for something, what they actually mean is I'm willing to kill for it. And so the war machine has had the greatest investment. And so when we get to the brink of a Nazi Germany, a Kuwait, etc., the only institution we have to turn to is the military. We don't have any other means to turn to anything else. So as I've used, and it sounds like a little bit of a glib example, that when the only tool you have in your box is a hammer, then everything starts looking like a nail. And so we rely on it again and again. Think of the trillions of dollars that have been spent on war in the last 100 years. You don't think that could have been utilized in alternative, truly defense mechanisms. And the lie, I mean, let's look at the lies. The lie, they fly into our buildings because they don't like our freedom and democracy. Lie number one. Lie number two, they have weapons of mass destruction. That Iraq's actually involved in all of it. These are all lies. All lies. And then the other lie is that we're going to solve this by further contributing. The lie then is that we're keeping all of you safe. It's a lie.
Yeah.
This country is now less safe than it has ever been in its history. And again, and I'll say this quite clearly, in my lifetime, on the corner of 43rd Street and 5th Avenue, New York, a bomb's going to go off. Safety is a myth. It's a myth. Feeding everyone, making sure everyone's got education and housing and can enjoy the fullness of life is true security. Mm-hmm. And this nation has the ability to contribute to that more than any other nation. And as John Marty last week was saying quite clearly, the American people, we believe we can do anything. Well, let's start stretching our imagination to achieve that. Let's go build schools. Let's go feed people. And then this nation can rest in peace.
I have.
Yeah, we'll come to you. Just a second.
Oh.
There's some people back there, but go ahead.
Oh, well, just add this. I had the privilege of serving on the ELCA Peace Task Force about a decade ago, and it produced the ELCA Peace Statement. And one of the members of about 30 of us was a retired four-star general. And I even roomed with him one night. And in the morning, I didn't know whether to say good morning or salute. fine man. And I'll never forget one thing he said as, one who'd been a military man, general. And he said that we could cut our defense budget in half and it wouldn't make any difference. Even talking about military security. But then his dream was that we fund a peace academy, and this would be funded equally with West Point and the Navy and the Air Force Academy, have equal funding to show the great importance. And his dream was that then we would find the finest minds and train them at this great academy in the ways of nonviolent peacemaking. And it really touched my heart because this was not coming from what we used to call a peacemaker. This is coming a retired four-star general who was a committed Christian. So,
let's go to this gentleman here and then to the back. Yeah.
Hey. In my generation, I opposed HD.
Can you speak louder?
I was led to believe and was fed the line that preparedness for war was the greatest deterrence for war, that military might is the greatest peacekeeping because the no nation or entity would dare strike because of our second strike capability, so the fear of the punishment of retaliation. That to me, I rejected back in my high school days, that preparedness for war only assures that you're going to use that mechanism for conflict resolution. And then we went into a new paradigm, which just to me is absolute lunacy, that we as a nation should strike another nation if we think they are prepared for war, whether it be weapons of mass destruction or showing moving troops or whatever in a hostile way. That's justification to strike first, rather than no one will dare strike us because we can strike back. I keep coming back that peace begins individually in a personal level, and collectively then we cultivate a society who finds conflict resolved by peaceful means rather than fear of the violence that that military might deliver. So I want to see all peacemaking to begin at an individual level, just like it's been taught to us by Gandhi and the Martin Luther King Jr. And we cultivate this in a new generation and bring up our children collectively to believe that that's what works. Because as you started out to say, military might is an absolute failure. So we got to find ways that work.
Thanks very much. Go to the back over here, and then we'll come over here.
Yeah, I'm going to stand up just because it's hard to hear over there. I come from a German background, and I remember a couple of things, you know, in answer to the thing about World War II being the just war. And that is, my grandparents, I remember them talking about World War I and how after that, the Allies demanded really intense preparations for that war, and it pretty much cast Germany into poverty. And I remember my grandparents going over there and talking about visiting their relatives who owned like one pair of very thin clothes, and all the shame and anger that they felt, you know, toward, well, just in general. And so that sort of, that built and allowed a lot of the issues with, you know, why people would fall for somebody like the Nazis and so forth. Then I also remember studying in high school about how something got declassified after World War II, and that Hitler, I'm having a hard time with my words, the leadership disagreed on whether or not he should go into Austria or not. And the deal had been made that if England or anybody protested, then they would stop that particular movement, but instead the English had sent a telegram of congratulations or some such thing. So those kind of things led up to it. Mm. It didn't just happen.
Thanks. Yeah, Tyler, and then over here.
It seems to me that we've handed too much control over these military decisions to leaders that are so disconnected from everyone else, and that it seems like military decisions are one of those things that are perceived to be totally beyond our the everyday person's capability to discern what would be the best course of action, and so these decisions are being made, without any seemingly any input by normal people. They're made by these military leaders and by people in back rooms who have red buttons, and they have, you know, all the information, and we have none of it. And we don't have any voice. And so when we're talking about, nice community grassroots protests in Washington with the police lining, the whole thing, it sounds ridiculous we can talk about Vietnam or something that proved effective to have protesting or something, but it seems reactionary rather than what can we do to change the way that these decisions are being made by people that are out of touch with reality?
I mean, I would just lift up what Alan already said, which is run for office. John Marty is a candidate who would do this kind of thing, that would really try and say, we can do better than this. We can do better than what we've done in terms of national security and war. And I just feel like if the people in this, out of the village right now, some of the people who have just graduated from college decide, I'm going to go into politics. I don't think that's a necessary trajectory for being co-opted. I think John Marty's an example of a person who spent a long time in politics with deep integrity, fighting for a different way of public life. So I think that's a really valuable thing to hold up.
And I think it takes many different people to build a bond. It's a huge industry.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, the B-52 bomber is manufactured in a lot of states in this country. And that's done specifically and strategically, because it does create jobs. But if you ever want to scuttle the development of that technology, you're dealing with many states. And there are many interest groups on that. And how many people want to stand for office, knowing that they're going to put people out of work? So it is a huge, huge industry. It's not about a pilot. It's not about a general with four pips on his shoulder. It's a huge industry. I would call upon the church of this nation to call troops to refuse to go to the war. That's what I'd call. Churches need to offer that. People need to see it's a respectable thing not to go to war. It's a Jesus thing. Let's put that voice out there. Or are our churches so polarized that we can't say that? Would we be then labeled red or blue? So can you see there's this whole system that we need to resist at many different levels. At many different levels.
Let's go over here.
This is an agreement with kind of the, I think we need to start on an individual level. When I reflect on my childhood, my mom loves to tell a story of me in second grade. I was being bullied in the playground, and I would come home for a week to 2 weeks straight telling about how I was being bullied by this one kid. And after weeks of hearing this and suffering herself watching me come home struggling with this, she gave me the advice to punch him the next day. I juxtapose this to your story, Alan, which is vastly different. And I don't remember this personally, but my mom tells me this story. And so I did, the next day I did, I went and did that. And I just think about the unlearning that I've had to do. And I can empathize with my mother. I can understand how difficult that would be to watch a child going through that. But if we could teach people that is the unlearning I've had to do is pretty profound just from that. It was against my grain. I've never punched another person in my life since that moment. It's against the grain of who I am, but at the same time, that just taught me that there are occasions when it's necessary. My mom was always, you know, be a nice person, don't cause bombs, but occasionally it's necessary.
One of the atomic bombs was named Little Boy.
I've heard it said a few times already in this room that wars are failures, and military might is a failure. And I agree with that insofar as if peace is the goal, then wars have been amazing failures. But I don't know if that's why wars are fought as much as to gain wealth and resources for a minority of people. And in that way, they've been exceedingly successful. And speaking for myself, I'm someone in a country who's living, you know, with the benefits of those wars from all the way back to the Revolutionary War till now. So it seems to me that if, and this is what I've been wrestling with for a while, to truly live the vocation of a Christian peacemaker as a comfortable American, it's, you have to be afflicted and question wealth or privilege or any of that. And so I'm just wondering if you all might speak some on the relationship of economics and war, the relationship of affluence and peacemaking, those relationships.
Well, from my theological tradition, John Wesley, anyone heard of John Wesley? A quick story about John Wesley. He writes in his journal that he went to Eldersgate Church, Little Methodist Church in Eldersgate Street in the UK, and he went there, and he went rather reluctantly, he writes in his journal, and when he got there, someone was reading Luther's preface to his commentary to the letter to the Romans. Now, you probably don't get anything more boring than Luther's preface to the Romans, okay? And while it was being read, John Wesley felt his heart strangely warmed, and that's what was later his kind of conversion, or one of his conversion moments. Wesley would say that if you don't, every cent that you have extra that is not going to the hungry, you're basically robbing from the poor. If you've got extra clothes, you are causing others to be naked. Direct causal relationship. Direct causal. So I think what you've put your finger on is what I would agree with 100%, that it seems that the overwhelming, I would want to say, violence in this world is actually economic. Economic. That we can count body bags coming home or staying at a war, but there are far more countless body bags as a result of economics. So there are many ways to kill a person. And so economic injustice, I would say, is the primary violence that exists in this world today. And it's killing tens of thousands of people on a daily basis around the world. So I would agree 100% with that.
Yeah,
let's
go over here.
I have three questions to connect. Kind of take your pick on what I'd like to say. So I'll preface this first one by saying, like, I'm not sure how much I agree with it, but it seems to me that violence is in some sense arbitrary, because these examples that you've brought up, like including the civil rights movement in the U.S., and my knowledge of the apartheid movement isn't great, so I won't comment on that. And the movement in India were all non-violent movements. But that's not to say that they didn't do incredible damage to the oppressing nation, largely economically. Like when there was the bus boycott, I mean, white bus drivers lost their jobs, weren't able to pay the families. Or in India, they did incredible damage to the British economic system. And so in some sense, like, firing a bullet definitely, I would say, is worse at a person is worse than, I'm not sure where exactly I'm going with this, but it does, in some sense, seem, I mean, you're doing damage to the oppressing nation in either instance, and so if I could just get your comment to that, the next two will be quicker. Number one, my knowledge of Luther isn't as extensive, I'm sure, as some people in this room, but he did say that while you can't defend, defend yourself with violence, it is justified to do so for other people. And lastly, in lots of instances of genocide, the victimized nation, while not intentionally nonviolent, are essentially so because they don't have the resources to defend themselves, and yet the genocide continues. And so those would be instances in which point to the fact that nonviolent movements may not be as successful as you seem to think they are. So if I could have any comments on that.
Just to mention a nonviolent movement like Gandhi's or Martin Luther King's, my guess is they would never deny that the movement is hurting people. For example, a boycott. But it's the absolute refusal to use violence and kill people. But it is a power method. People will come to say, well, this is hurting us economically. The fact that, for example, thousands of people are on strike from work, and that so it's a technique, but it's a technique that begins with saying we will not shed blood. You see the.
And there are consequences. There are consequences for setting up an unjust structure. White privilege. It's an unjust structure. The request from the prophets are, please dismantle the structure. Please dismantle the structure. It's not pleasing unto God and to your neighbor. If, however, you refuse to willingly dismantle the structure, it will come tumbling down, and there will be people getting hurt in the tumbling down of it. So we bump into those consequences. I forget your second and...
Just Luther and then the instances of genocide and what...
Luther's yours, Dan.
I know a lot about Wesley. Luther did teach what's known as a just war theory. And if it were truly followed, we would be in very few wars. And also, we seldom are the Luther quotes that are really against war and for peace. They're seldom printed. And also, his words against the Jews, were used by the Nazis. So, Luther, thankfully, we don't worship Luther.
Amen.
I mean, he was saint and sinner, as he taught us all to say we are saints and sinners. Like the grandparent that asked the little child if you were. All the good people were green and all the red people were, or the bad people were green and the red people were, I'm getting mixed up on my color chart here, but two different colors. If all the bad people were one and all the good people were the other, what color would you be? And the little child answered, striped. Striped. This is what, you know, there should have been, could have been a massive Lutheran protest at the beginning of the Iraq War because President Bush named three countries as the axis of evil. And this absolutely counters Lutheran teaching, Luther's teaching, called simul justus et peccator, simultaneously saint and sinner. And for our president to teach theology to the nation that is in direct conflict with ours, there should have been a doctrinal uprising. But we were all quiet. This is, and it, I really believe it's our guilt.
And then maybe to your, the Rwanda question? The, well,
genocide.
So I think if we're going to, part of peacemaking in my understanding is allowing Jesus to define who I am and who everyone is. It's about identification. If I identify myself, Brian has been teaching the last 2 weeks, and one of the frameworks that Brian uses, he asks the question, before we're going to ask any questions about nuclear, hydro, anything like that, he says, just two questions. The place, where do you want this to work? Is it just the country that we're going to have clean energy, or is it going to be larger than the country, to the continent, to the world? And so place and then time. And that's very, very helpful. If I identify myself as with my family name, that's a very limited identity. There are about six human beings on this earth at this moment that can identify themselves with that same identity. Or if I say I come from Johannesburg, it gets a little larger, then South Africa, then Africa. At each point where I've decided to claim an identity, it's exclusive at some point. And I want to suggest that the potential for conflict and war exists at the boundary point of that identity. So if I say I'm a South African, well then, potentially anyone who's not. And so, if my understanding of Jesus is correct, I am called in his name to claim an identity for myself that all people can claim. I'm a child of God, and so are you. And that's the only identity I'm willing to claim. It's the only flag I'm willing to fly. You are more than your flag. The only symbol I'm willing to put on a piece of material is the globe, with all its galaxies. Stars and stripes don't do it. It's too small. You are more than that. It's a false identity. Remember your baptism. We are born into the family of God, which includes everyone. So for me, it's a long way of answering the question of identity. Now, let's go to Rwanda and let's speak of a Muslim community. A Muslim community that decided that their true identity was not Hutu or Tutsi. Their true identity was in their faith. As Muslims are a desperate minority in Rwanda, and there's a particular Muslim community that are made up of both Hutu and Tutsi who remained faithful, caring to one another throughout the genocide because they dared to claim another identity, a larger identity. And maybe it was because of their minority status as Muslims that had refined them enough to do that. So peacemaking for me is teaching our children who they are and who their true family is. And their true family is every human being in the world. And I think if we can claim that identity, it will go a long way.
Thank you.
but I'm just saying. I read a story this year in Christianity Today magazine, and it was a missionary conference in Rwanda, and mostly evangelical, as so-called. And in the midst of this conference, one of the Rwandan pastors stood up. No, it was one of the lay people, I think, that stood up and pointed to the missionaries and said, you taught us to believe in Jesus, but you never taught us to live in peace. And more is being said today about Matthew 28, 18 through 20. And this would be true of my ministry and many others, that we have emphasized the first half of that verse, go into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, period. And we leave off, and teaching them to observe all I have commanded you. And then, lo, I am with you. And according to the story, after he said this, there was just dead silence in this conference that had been talking mostly about statistics and numbers of baptisms. It was very, very striking. Hold it some more.
Let me just read what Martin Luther says based on Matthew chapter 5, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. This is classic Luther. He always, in the catechism, will say what you shouldn't do, but then what you should do. So here he says, therefore, anyone who claims to be a Christian or a child of God not only does not start war or unrest, but gives help and counsel on the side of peace wherever she or he can, even though there may have been a just and adequate cause for going to war. It's sad enough if one has tried everything and nothing helps, and then one has to defend oneself to protect one's land and people. So he goes a very long way before allowing for protection. And he doesn't say in the first instance in this that you use violent means for protection. So I think one of the challenges with Luther is to try and understand that his willingness was to let himself totally be undefended, totally. And for the sake of another person, he was willing to step in between that person and harm in order to defend them as a way to love the neighbor. And he, partly because he was a man of his time, took that argument to the point of saying there could possibly be a war that you could justify on the basis of that means. Although he said it would never be good, it would be evil. So I think there's very little room in Luther actually for saying gung-ho, just war. And he's often read that way, and it's just not there in what he wrote. The end.
Well,
and then
think,
let's come across this way.
I think Ellen's point about a national identity being too small is absolutely right. And we all have one. So the part of the complexity of living a life of peace and following Jesus is that we have this cosmos to which we belong, but we also belong to a polis. And so to be a cosmopolitan in that sense, not in the classical sense, requires that the ideals and the myth in the strong sense, the story that shapes our life from our religious tradition, doesn't always match with the strong stories of our national location and our national identity. So I actually have a kind of sympathetic response to Madeleine Albright, which is, why should we think that the Secretary of Defense of the United States or Secretary of State of the United States should, in her political role, take her brief from Jesus? What gives us that idea? It's not in her charge. It's not in her job description, right? Nobody said to her, You should follow, your job is to help the United States follow Jesus. Nobody ever told her that. Nobody will tell her that. Because of the other structures that we have in the United States about how religion and government work together. Now, I'm not saying, so what I want to say then is the challenge for us is to figure out how those bigger ideals can be infused into the systems in which we find ourselves in such a way as to modify them. But as long as we have the system that we now have, to think that the Secretary of State is going to follow Jesus as she's making international policy is deluded. We have to help change things. We have to figure out ways that people who don't share our same faith tradition can be made allies in an effort to have a better way.
Let's go back here, and then we'll go up here.
Powerful comment over here, and I had a non-war question, so it's okay. Going away from that. Is that okay right now?
Yeah, fine.
I've been really loving what you said, Alan, and the 2,000 years ago is an important day in my life. My question revolves around prayer and how much of my prayer should be about confessing my sins. Is it a rock in my bucket if I'm spending too much time saying, I'm such a sinner, I'm such a bad person, please forgive me, because it was, could you talk a little bit about that? You get the rest of my question, right?
If you're a sinner, so you should be.
Maybe give a little lesson in prayer. What should our prayer be like, since you said it's so important today, and I want to be a better at praying, but I feel like a lot of my time is spent.
Sure. Can I have coffee with you afterwards?
Oh, okay. All right, that'd be great.
Let's let people, even though it's a valid question for Alan, it's not necessarily on topic for the forum directly, the way that you phrased it.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you can find afterwards, or unless you want to make it connected to
the war?
Praying for
peace.
Yeah,
it's
a question
on
the design.
Yeah.
Can I share a resource?
There's someone who, there's a woman up here who had, if you want to comment on this now. Yeah.
Well, I would just say that it does seem to be Jesus' first command after he says, love your enemies, then pray. So it seems to me, if I'm reading it correctly, that the first thing I need to do on the journey of loving is to pray. And things that I would certainly pray for is the ability to be able to see the enemy as family, to not lose sight of that truth, to see the enemy as one lived for, died for, and resurrected for by Jesus, to see the enemy as no worse than I. Both of us are fallen and striped. That's what I would be praying for, so that in my engagement with the enemy, be it in a conversation with a politician or wherever, that I do not lose sight of their humanity, that in my engagement I treasure their humanity, and that they will feel it treasured even though we disagree with one another. And so that would be the kind of prayer that I'd certainly want to pray. The other side is to pray for the huge stone in my bucket, which is fear. To ask God to make me fearless, in love, and trusting that perfect love does cast out fear. And so, oh God, overwhelm me with your love. Overwhelm me. Remind me that I live and move and have my being in you. Remind me that whether I live to the Lord. If I die, I die to the Lord. So then, whether I live or whether I die, I'm yours, O Lord. Give me that assurance so that when I am in the face of a direct encounter with the threat to my life, I will not fear that person. That's what I would pray for. And as I've said in my sessions, and this is not in any way to belittle physical life, but the death of physical life is not the worst thing that can happen to me. The worst thing that can happen to me is me to stop loving. And I die every time I choose to stop loving. And so I need to be praying for resurrection over and over again in my life. I don't know if that's...
I have one thought about the bucket with the stone and the water, and that is that I find my biggest trouble in prayer is when I turn the bucket upside down and there's no water getting in. It's just full of rocks, but it's upside down. So I think that for me, it's a constantly get the bucket right upright so that I can be filled and washed. But that aside, my question regarding war is the whole aspect that it has become entertainment, at least in this question, in this country. And I found it really appalling during Desert Storm that every morning we could wake up and turn the television on and get the latest update on the smart bombs and their accuracy. And it was like a video game, the television, and these were real buildings and real desert and real people, but it was like watching a game show. And I think that there's such a huge industry in the entertainment part of war, and I would love to have a comment on that.
You agree, but I see it part of the propaganda to keep us supporting war. And we've seen no dead bodies, no caskets from this war. And it's hard to not think it's intentional. So it's fun. There's some real joy in being a resistor. I like to perform, during the news, I like to perform exorcisms at the TV. just a sign of a cross in front of the screen, when you know somebody is trying to take you away from Jesus.
Gary had a comment up here, and then we'll go back.
One of the resources that I found helpful is A Theology of Nonviolence by Charles Emmanuel McCarthy. And he used to teach at Notre Dame University. And he's an Eastern Rite Byzantine priest. And he founded Pax Christi. And he says the whole biblical teaching on peacemaking is a thin tradition. And it's been ignored both in Israel and in Europe. And in the later church after Constantine. But he's the only one I know that has made a systematic theology of nonviolence. And it's an amazing resource. And we had some people go to a retreat, and they said, we have never heard anything like this, we've never seen anything like this, and it has changed our lives. And they are yeast within the parish that they're a part of. So again, his name is Charles Emmanuel McCarthy, and it's A Theology of Nonviolence, and I commend it to you.
Thanks, Gary. It reminds me, Notre Dame's one school that actually offers a program in peacemaking as part of the university's degrees. We're at time, so we need to stop, and I want to thank Alan and Dan for standing in front of us.